Welcome back to season 4 of the Read Connected podcast. The theme of season 4 is all about connection. Connection with others, connection with something outside yourself, and connection within yourself. Today, we're so pleased to be joined by Boston music scene rock star Will Daly to talk about the way in which music has created connections in his life. We'll get into that discussion shortly, but first let's cover his robust resume as a musician, recording artist, and performer. Will Daly is an acclaimed independent recording artist, performer, and artist advocate. His sound has been described as a Venn diagram of multiple genres with a rich vintage vibe channeled through his authentic, wry, and energetic performances. All-inspiring famed rock journalist Dan Acqualiente to call him the real deal, as we agree. Daly's albums are met with stellar reviews. They have 13 million spins on Spotify, top 20 on the National Billboard Heatseeker chart twice, and he's won 8 Boston Music Awards, including Album of the Year, Artist of the Year, for his album, National Throat. By the way, I have a signed copy of that record that he released after leaving Universal Records to start his own label. He shared the stage and studio with Eddie Vedder, Willie Nelson, Roger McGinn, Kay Hanley, G-Love, Steve Earle, and Tanya Donnelly. In June of 2013, he was featured on Stephen King and John Mellencamp project produced by T-Bone Burnett called Ghost Brothers of Darkland County. And in the same year, also released an original song he wrote inspired by Jack Kerouac's Tristessa. Daly's played at Farm Aid 4 times alongside Neil Young, Willie Nelson, Dave Matthews, and John Mellencamp. His latest album, Golden Walker, which I can't wait to talk more about, was released the summer of 2018 and hit number 1 on Billboard's Northeast Heatseekers. The Boston Herald called the album a new peak and named it the album of 2018. In 2021, Daly set out to play 100 shows across America, sharing the stage with Brandi Carlile, one of our favorites, Sharon Van Etten, and Pearl Jam. During the COVID crisis, Daly got to work and raised over $32,000 for non-salary employees of venues in Boston, other artists, and the city of Chelsea through online performances, oftentimes from his own shower to get the right acoustics. In summer of 2022, Daly released his single, Easy to Be Around, his first new music since the Before times in 2019. Easy to Be Around shares an airy groove, but there's a 68-second surprise attached to it. The single slides into a second song that lists the full credits from the instrumentalist to the cover artist and all the audio engineers in between. In an era of music history that's ruled by algorithms, that double single of sorts could be considered a risk. Daly continued his path of human connection over algorithms by releasing the single, Cover of Clouds, exclusively at his merch table while on tour for a one-time listen. A song that never came out on platforms, only to be heard on a pair of headphones at the merch table and a Discman. Those who took the ride heard almost 7 minutes opus, a meditation on Joni Mitchell, another favorite of mine, and the influences pivotal artists on a younger artist path. Once again, Will Daly disrupts industry norms, not the other way around. Now, Will and I have had numerous run-ins over the years since I've been here in Boston. When I moved up here from New Jersey, having been accustomed to the New York City music scene, where I could find any number of incredible musicians touring, testing, or playing, even the smallest spaces, I was worried that Boston wouldn't be able to meet my musical expectations. I was pretty spoiled. An old friend of mine, who is a beloved singer-songwriter himself, now down in Arlington, Virginia, said, Lex, you'll find your people in spaces. You need to look up this guy, Will Daly. You'll like his sound and vibe. Lo and behold, my old high school friend Taylor Carson was right. I started seeing Will's shows back in 2008 on some of the famed stages here in Boston, Cambridge, and Somerville, at Brewery Oktoberfest, and on a boat around the harbor, and many other venues. We've talked shop from an educational perspective, and I nearly taught his stepson, Aiden, as he ended up in the class I taught in the year before when I just switched to a new school. Above and beyond all else, Will epitomizes connection in so many ways. We're grateful to have him here with us today to talk about his journey, inspirations, creative aspirations, as well as so much more.
Wow.
Welcome, Will.
Thanks for that.
We're pretty stoked to have you here. I feel like we've had probably parts of this conversation over the years and shared jokes and shared insights. I think going through some of the heaviness of the past few years that everybody's collectively shared together, you've been a guiding light in a lot of ways through social media, which is, I don't know about for you. For me, it kind of feels icky sometimes because I love the personal connection and I find such value in it. But it was also such a beautiful way to just continue the theme, the song, the journey of who you are, what you do, and keeping people going. Mm. So thank you for that.
Thank you. No, social media is pretty icky.
We talk about that a lot here, that it's so powerful and also just doesn't always feel great.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's interesting. So is an automobile. You know, they're pretty icky and they're destroying our the air that we breathe and the land that we were bestowed, we paved over, but it also got us places. And when you break a leg, you can get to the hospital sooner because of a car.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we've always have to wrestle with these things and find balance. And you can actually drink too much water, you know, and poison yourself. And you can, by the fire you warm yourself by, you can get burned. So it's not a rare thing. It's not unique to social media.
Well said.
Will, one of the things that strikes me about you watching you perform in Somerville over December last year is I'm always trying to pay attention to people's energy and your energy when you're performing. I just feel like you genuinely just are in it. You really like to do what you're doing. Like there's something very pure about it. Can you just speak a little bit to that? We're kind of jumping ahead to just your performances. But there is something special about your performances because that's where you connect with people. And, you know, this season is about connection and, you know, you're connecting with your audience in that way. So can you just tell me about that pureness? And am I accurate in saying that in terms of how you feel when you're performing?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, and maybe it wasn't always that way. There are, you know, using even the social media example, you can take the positives of it as well. On one hand, and the other is, in the case of my industry, you're always being told you're not enough through social media.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout my time in the business of music, which when you have the affliction of not being able to stop doing something like I have with music and so many others do, right? That you will at some point wade into the waters of the business of it. And I think it sometimes my young age, I could be pulled out of the importance of performing. And I refuse to have anybody rob me of that moment anymore. And that happened, it took a long time to refuse. I remember one time I was opening for Pete Yorn in like a beautiful theater. And it was like a big deal for me to open up for him and just be on this bill in this giant, probably like 700, 800 type space that predated sound systems. It was so ornate and gorgeous and stuff like that. And we had done the sound check and everything. And we walked out and the band started playing. All our equipment worked, but the front of house was out. Like something that had gone wrong, a fuse had blown or whatever. And so I went to sing, nothing came out. My band started to panic. The song started to waver and teeter back, you know, and I just stopped everything because I could see techs on the side of the stage being like, okay, oh, they knew it was wrong, but they're not going to rush your stage or anything like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was just a stop. And then I realized once we stopped, because the place was so old, the sound carried so perfectly because it was designed to exist before audio and I was like, I got to do something here. And one option would be to walk off stage, which would really kind of demoralize the energy that you have to get up to walk out there, especially as the opener and stuff like that. And even as the headliner, I've seen headliners have all kinds of tech issues and have it go every which way. But I just grabbed I let everyone, all the techs rush on stage and figure things out. And some guys in my band were just like, you know, deer in the headlights. And I said, you guys can hop off. And I grabbed an acoustic guitar and walked out to the edge of the stage and just sang on my acoustic guitar, "You Can't Always Get What You Want" by the Rolling Stones, because it seemed appropriate.
Spontaneously.
Yeah. And it sounded so gorgeous. And then I guess what happened behind me was that, like, everyone figured out the problem. And then my band's like, okay, they snuck back on stage and kicked into the song with me. And I got up to the mic. So it just, something going wrong became so unique and powerful. And that was like early on in my career. And it informed like a couple things. Like, when things go wrong, it's a great opportunity to upset expectations, because expectations can be so dismantling to having a unique experience and having an honest experience and a wholesome experience. And when everything falls apart, you can kind of get to the core, like all the structures we build around our lives and all the demands we put upon ourselves and each other. When an emergency happens, you're like, what's the most important thing? And you wrap your arms around that and rebuild and try to keep that intact. And I guess, you know, going back to your original question, is that with the structures that are built around the music business, which are what we can get into, but have been commiserated for decades now, for the music business that has existed for the last 100 years, they really don't matter. You know, the Grammys are great and can be inspirational and be amazing to win one, but they're not as real as like the moment of creation. And no matter what happens to Taylor Swift or Beyonce up there, getting that award does not feel better than when they write the new song and they have that moment of creation, or when they get it right on track, or when they're in front of 10 to 10,000 people nailing the performance with feeling in sync with the audience. Those things are ancient on the cellular level. Like, we started with food, hunting, gathering, cooking, sex, and shelter, and music. And we've been evolving with those original elements. When you keep that intact, and when I'm on stage and I remind myself, my guitar tuning doesn't matter, my pitch doesn't matter, the amount of people in the room doesn't matter at all. Like, there's no difference now, and I've done it all, you know, all the levels of audience size. The only thing that matters is answering to that truth. And that doesn't mean that I'm always nailing it. And when I get off track, I'd be like, wait a second, dude, get to that cellular level and that human element, because everybody in that room needs that, is asking you to do that, whether they know it or not. And you have 5 minutes to 2.5 hours every show to continuously access that. And maybe why I started with that, like that show where everything went wrong and the power didn't work, is sometimes things going wrong or weird, or, you know, Mick Jagger didn't move like that in the beginning, but when he started to move like that, his movement breaks down your expectations originally when he started to move like that. Now you expect him to move like that.
Maybe, but not at this age.
Right. Well, yeah, it's
still
astounding that he can do it.
Expectations.
You know? Yeah. True. Well, it truly is doing something. But also for him, and I feel this, and someone's like, hey, you moved weird on stage. Well, sometimes if I'm moving weird, it's like I have to take the rigidness out of my body, or the thinking, or the, where am I now? Is everyone having a good time? Is the front of house sound good? Did we sell enough tickets? Did this happen? And I have to just like shock my body into like remembering like my center and my core and like let go. Or like the music is taken over. All those things are true. And my job, I'll probably say this again in our conversation, is not music. Like, into the theme of your season here, music I would do no matter what. You know, and if I had a day job, I'd be a horrible employee, because I'd just be waiting to punch out and go do music at home, you know? My job is connection. That's how I'm employed, you know?
There's so many things you just said that I know we're going to just dive all over. But speaking of social media, just this morning, I just posted this African proverb that talks about how when the roots are strong, you're not as afraid of the wind. Mm-hmm. And thinking about that Maramora song, The Bones, and thinking about the foundation and everything you described about your experience is like really getting honest and true with yourself and remembering why you're doing what you're doing so that regardless of what happens, your truest self just shines through. And it's apparent, you know, this is why we wanted you to come here on the show. The name of our company is Reed Connect, and it's a bunch of dots. And it's about us and our work and our jobs trying to find ways to help people connect the dots, to figure out the bigger picture of what's happening for them in their lives. And to be able to do that through music, which for me, it's like the one of the few ways that I can shut my brain off and just be present in a moment. Yeah. It's like such a beautiful thing. And it's, I think, one of the greatest gifts. So I love the way you described all of that.
I got a couple things stood out to me, what you said. One is, you have to be a very courageous dude, I would say, because when things go wrong, right, it's not human nature to pause and be reflective. Mm. So I think you have a lot of courage in you, and also you're very reflective, which I think allows for transformation to happen, which is one of the most important things as a therapist. We're always trying to help people to transform. So there's something that is really special inside of you that allows you to have the whole, you know, everything going wrong, and yet you're going to be in the moment and see what can come from it. See what can come from it. And that's, you know, what a beautiful story that was. And that is probably where your songs come from too, is when you are present. And so when we think of connection, I think this is a story about connecting within yourself. Mm. And when things go wrong, it's a reminder to think back about what is our foundation, what is our core. So it seems like you use things going wrong as a reminder to look back into yourself and to find what's important.
Yeah. And have faith in yourself that it may be weird if things are going to go wrong, first of all, right?
And
Pleasantville is not the movie.
Our best, you know, we are a creature of myth, but our best stories are based on things going wrong within myth. And like this summer we had a thing on the roof of Fenway, like a concert on the roof of Fenway before a game. And it was going well. And then all of a sudden, the guy at Fenway was like, "You got to stop. Lightning's coming in.
Oh, man.
We can't have you on the roof here in this roof garden area."
She's scary.
It's one of my favorite parts of Fenway. For people who don't know.
Oh, yeah, the garden.
The gardens of Fenway Park.
Yeah.
They have this whole sustainable urban garden, which is amazing. It was so cool to know that you were able to play there, too.
Yeah, and the gardens, so cool. Like the produce goes into the restaurants there.
Exactly.
It's nice.
It's really nice.
And I was like, well, people paid to be here, and we are like 6 songs into 15 songs and stuff like that. And so I just, you know, grabbed an acoustic and went under the awning while everyone scrambled and cleaned up. And a lot of these stories end up with me like having a good time while everyone's working really hard behind me. And just continued like the show old school in a circle style with the whole crowd tucked in tight under the awning.
Oh, man.
Sick.
How cool.
But also, like, when things go wrong, all the other, like, the juju stuff we're talking about, yes. Yeah. But everyone gets to see, like, things go wrong for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Normalizes.
People are at that show who have things going wrong in their life all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It just happened right now. And the concert amount shifted and stayed with us.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's just, again, the job is connection. They get to go home and be like, okay, how do I pivot, you know, and do something? And then also, just this is almost like on a business level, like I think I created a more memorable day than like, I bought a ticket to a concert. I showed up and there was a concert.
So
I know,
true.
I bought a ticket to a concert. It went awry and this is what happened. And there's just a little bit more memory. And the two moments I just mentioned, you know, people keep talking to me about years later, you know? So
that's beautiful.
I'm like, sometimes like, hey, how do we orchestrate things going wrong?
You know, it's so interesting. From an executive function perspective, I'm always talking about how do we predict and prepare, right? If we can predict and prepare, we can develop a little bit of automaticity to kind of allow for our brains to have that creative expansion and freedom. Yeah. But in reality, like our memories that get formed that are usually the most important and nostalgic are those memories when what we predict doesn't go as we expected.
Yeah.
And those are the things we hold on to and we cherish. And if you are too rigid and if you do hold too tight, sometimes you miss the beauty of, I think, what life's all about.
And you get further injured.
Yeah. Do you know the Buddhist story of the second dart?
I have no idea.
Oh, you'll love this one. Yeah. So my meditation teacher introduced me to a lot of amazing things, but this is probably one of my favorites I share with a lot of my clients, that when something goes wrong, it's like getting hit with a dart and you're like, oh, that hurts. Like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, I can't believe I got hit by a dart. But the pain of that first dart hitting you actually isn't the pain you're really experiencing. It's the pain of the second dart coming in because you're like, why did I get hit with that dart? Why did that happen to me? I can't believe that happened to me. How am I going to go on? And the internal dialogue that you start to develop, that narrative around, oh, everything's just going to fall apart for me. This is going to be the worst thing ever because this bad thing happened, is the pain of the second dart.
Mm-hmm.
And how often do we fall into that trap instead of being like, oh, that sucked. What can I do now? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, you're like now two darts shy of having a whole set of darts for yourself. I mean, you know, then you can have your own game of darts. So there's that too. I think that's what the Buddhists were implying.
Yeah. All right, you just read my mind well, because my next comment was going to be about how when you were on stage, you're quite funny.
So funny.
And the irony of our conversation right now is that actually when I was in grad school, I took a cognitive science class, and for some reason, one of our books, like our required readings, was on humor. I can't remember the name of the book, but it was just a whole book about humor. And like one of the core tenets of the book is humor basically happens when your expectations are not met in a very unexpected way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's exactly, well, all hooks are made by upsetting patterns.
Mm. In songs, you're saying?
No, I think in anything. Like,
yeah.
So a joke lands because you're, yeah, I'm with you. Okay. Yeah. You walked into the bar with three, a nun, a priest, or whatever, you know, and it's, you've heard that one before, and the joke lands when you upset the pattern in some, in some way.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny. I mean, all of music is interconnected.
Mm.
And a hook is when you take that interconnection and just upset the pattern a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And we could take any great song that's buried in our hearts or minds right now and find a lot of threads that would blow your mind. Like, we might think Billie Jean by Michael Jackson or Antihero by Taylor Swift is like this original standalone thing. There's just so many other things connected to it, but it took a handful of things and upset some patterns. And you need a little bit of familiarity with all story, with all narratives, with all music, with all melody, with all jokes. And you just take it, and then the stuff that's really successful just twists it a little bit. You know? And
that's so cool. I once listened to an NPR show that they were talking about how creativity and newness doesn't necessarily happen, right? Everything that is created from here on out is kind of like an alteration or a shift or change or a play on something that already exists.
Yeah.
And I think it's so interesting, especially from the music perspective. I mean, part of why I love what you do and you connect so well with people is because you're constantly evolving and thinking of new ways to create and to share your music and your craft and your talent, which is not just about music. As Jerry mentioned, you are not only a great dancer like Mick Jagger on stage when you're feeling the flow, but also that, like, in between you tell these great stories and you are just real and funny and you put yourself out there. I'm wondering if you talk a little bit about that, like, idea of creativity and how to keep things going and keep it fresh in a world where a lot of things seem to be recycled.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it comes from you first have to accept kind of that ancient cellular level as your primary driving force with life and art and stuff like that. And my joy and my time through this is more important than, which takes work initially and throughout and daily to say the construct thrusted around all of art is not real. And I cannot allow myself to measure my own artistic and personal value by the constructs placed around art. And I can get more into my thoughts on that. But my creativity comes to, I guess, back to that job, as my job is connection, not music. And music is me, and my job is connection. And so, and creativity is making sure that I'm answering that call. And so, you know, how I might release stuff or the way I behave on stage, which is like, sure, I'm funny, but I know it's also a little weird because I'm just trying to break down that construct sometimes. You know, if I'm saying something that's like, oh, yeah, you don't hear a lot of front men talk that way in between tunes on a show where you're rocking out necessarily or move that way. I'm trying to keep myself centered in that ancient practice. Remember my job. Stay physically and emotionally present. And just be like, no to the construct of of the business of art, not just for myself, but for my peers and for my audience. I hate the word audience in a way, you know, for the people who are showing up, you know, because they're showing up for a reason and they deserve something. They deserve my respect. And if I have this knowledge, I'm trying to respect them by delivering like the $10 song project that way, because, you know, all of music, recorded music, is being thrown into abyss on a daily level, 100,000 songs a day.
Totally.
And
it's unbelievable.
From Bruce Springsteen and Beyonce all the way down to little old me, you know? And like, at some point, the creatives in the world, do we really think that's healthy to the people who are showing up for us? And are we really think that's healthy for our creations? And I'm not saying in totality either, like screw that. And I kind of resist those arguments too, like Spotify's evil, or I mean, Spotify, it will be gone.
It's a vehicle, right?
It's a vehicle and it'll be gone. If I told you,
really,
I mean, 15 years ago, at the end of this street right here, we're on Newbury Street, was Tower Records. Three floors of records. And if in 1998, the three of us walked in there, I go, hey, you guys, in 15 years, this place will be gone. Not just this one. All of them around the world will be gone. You're like, what are you talking about? You're tripping.
Right?
You know, and I'd be like,
totally.
No, I'm not. And
wait, real quick, you know what's funny is that's actually our office building now.
Oh my God, that's great. And I said, and your office will be there. We'll be doing a podcast. And I will be saying this exact story, saying, I told you guys and you didn't listen. So
back to the future.
Yeah. And the same is going to happen to Spotify, because the delivery of art does not matter. It's the art that matters. And it's our human expression and connection in the continuity of our right to do it is the only thing that matters. And so I forget the question, but
it's all good.
But I'm just protecting the health around the ancient practice in the cellular level with my choices, and not allowing the construct of the business to dictate who I can be in this life, what I can do for employment or work. What brings me peace and how I feel like I can bring others peace. And if it's only one person, which is how I always have to start and how I actually look at my music, because my goal is to use genre as an extension of the art and not choose a genre. And I think you pay a price within the construct for that, but it allows me to be like, I hope you don't like all my music, but if we spent time together, and you tell me a little bit, share about yourself, almost like a prescription. I can say, check out these two songs. I think you'd like them.
Yeah.
And they would be really important to you. And you would feel seen. And I would feel seen. And it would be strange for you to, or, you know, I can't imagine like anybody on a blanket level liking anything, everything I did would mean like I'm not really digging deep enough as a person or an artist.
Superficial a little bit,
Yeah. And that's what the construct of art does, the business of art, because, and I don't, I'm not here to make a boogeyman evil empire argument. Of course, a construct would build around art because it's free labor.
Yeah.
Based on human passions.
Mm-hmm.
And it always has and always will be. But once you start to see, you know, the real patterns of what's important about being human, it'd be really weird to turn your back on it and say, I'm just going to sit in this genre. I'm just going to answer to the construct of the business. And if you do that, the business will actually then spit you out at some point and be done with you.
I think that's a very lonely place a lot of people find themselves in, actually, where they feel like they're stuck only being like, you know, square peg in a hole, like they have to fit, they have to figure it out. And a lot of the clients we work with too actually express that they feel very stuck, like they have something inside of them they're trying to tap into, they're trying to figure out. And, you know, that's the blessing that we have in the work we do to help guide people to find their passions and their purpose. Because, I mean, we believe personally and professionally that's like the point of human existence. But also, you know, to really think about all of these aspects of things is really important. I don't think people give themselves enough time and space to say, what are the things that are really most important to me? How can I express them? Whether or not it fits in the genre or the whole that you're trying to...
Yeah,
it's so interesting. And I, you know, as you were saying all that, I was thinking about how there's probably a lot of artists out there that might be a little jealous of you, like, feeling so confident and being so courageous to be able to put it out there. And before, you know, I integrated your bio into the intro, I was actually writing almost the same thing, talking about it's really hard to like put a pin on exactly the way in which you create and share music. It's not one thing.
What my sound is, yeah.
And
I mean, thanks for saying it's courageous, but you know, I have to renew my courage almost daily, you know,
sure.
And there's like, we all have quiet moments and I'm like, what if I just played folk music with an acoustic guitar my whole life? Like, well, I would be in the folk music scene and I'd be protected within that construct.
Mm.
But then what if something called me
out?
What if something like said, well, what if my, the antenna or whatever it is, the muse or whatever you want to call it said, you need to get an electric guitar and turn it up to a 10 and just do a song of feedback. Well, I'd be kicked out in any genre. Would do that. The genre comes with the algorithm of online music, YouTube. The genre comes with press and media and people who accept you into those cohorts. And, you know, that's why it takes a lifetime for Joni Mitchell to get to the performance she did the other night at the Grammys, you know, because to do it the way that she did it and, you know, points in her career after she was a huge artist couldn't then get arrested, in the music business, you know. So it takes time for people to see it. And there's some, you know, I also check like, well, what are my privileges to even like think that way in the first place? A lot of it comes from just failure, you know, to trying to play it. It's not like
getting
I woke up
scrappy
as a child and like said, oh, I'm gonna do it my own way. It's like, no, like I went to those mountaintops. I went to those structures, you know? And had to run up an avalanche for a while till I said, like, I'm not really getting anywhere.
You earn that wisdom by going through things.
Totally.
Right. To a certain degree. I remember, you know, early on, like around my second record, being in LA and working with the producers, like, you're a little bit too quirky. Like, you could be a huge pop star. We got to drop the quirkiness and work with me and write songs with me. And I was on a label. So, you know, I was like, it made me feel gross in that conversation. Like it was, that's pretty much word for word. Like those things, like you're a little too quirky. And I was like, oh, and I remember my guitarist. He's like, that's your superpower.
I was going to say, thank you.
That's so sweet. Yeah. Like he got so mad on my behalf.
I'm glad he said that.
And I, you know, at that point, but I'm still internalizing advice. And in my mid 20s, I'm thinking, you know, in your mid-20s, you think like you've been through 10 years of adulthood at that point, right?
Yeah.
And it's a chemical reaction that happens to a lot at that age, to everyone at that age. And And I had been so many ups and downs in the business that I thought like, well, maybe this guy's, you know, I was looking for, I always believe in looking for mentorship, you know, even late in life.
For sure.
I hope I'm 80 years old looking for mentorship, totally. Even from a peer. Or I think the mistake is an 80-year-old not getting mentorship from a 20-year-old, you know, and vice versa.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And or that mentorship is actually secretly just a reciprocal relationship.
Totally.
However, so I was always, you know, I was always too in my life looking for Mr. Miyagi or Yoda, right?
Yeah.
And still do, and have like very emotional connections with people where I feel like I'm getting that. Mm. And so, you know, this guy, this producer, very businessy guy, is saying this to me, and the guitar, once he stopped, the guitarist, you know, pulled me aside. He's like, screw that dude, you know. And he injected me with the punk rock. And yeah. I'm like, oh man, you're right. And but I remember somewhere along the line saying, I am the choice of. I love to use genre as an extension of creativity, not a choice of the sound I'm going to use to get into the marketplace, you know, or the limits of my abilities. We have one shot that we know of that we can empirically point to. Mm. And I'm sure there's a lot more that I know. There's a lot more I don't know about who we are. Mm-hmm. However, empirically, I know the idea of Will Daly gets one shot, you know? And I would hate, as far as the way I feel about music, again, back to that intrinsic cellular level, to hear something, whether it be like prog, math, metal, be called to it and have to say no?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Or like, would be such a huge human mistake.
Mm. Mm.
Bigger than any business mistake.
You reminded me when you were talking about, you know, getting into the folk genre, and you could do that and you would probably be great at that. And I have to tell you that every single year when they say, which artist do you want to see at the Newport Folk Festival? I write your name in every single
Thank
year.
You. Well, that's a little bit of the problem. Like, I played a folk conference this year and the radio DJ from Chicago is like, I mean, I've known of you forever, but you're just too loud.
Oh my gosh.
Like, well, if you're listening to the loud song, sure. Like, but, you know, the past
Daniel
couple
Daniel Ratliff is loud.
Well, I know, but what happens is, you know, the since digitization, which is the thing I've come up in, is the compartmentalization there really has driven so much of what happens. And we are all a slave to this algorithm stuff. And,
yeah.
And we'll be here and there. And again, not that it's all bad. Like, we started with cars and these other examples, but.
Well, I was thinking about, you know, the disruption and, you know, I go to the Folk Fest every year. It's like my Christmas weekend. It's like my favorite thing.
Yeah,
Christmas in July.
Yeah, Christmas in July. It's a wonderful thing. And I brought my family and friends, and people feel the buzz. They feel the energy. And, you know, this year I was like, I don't know enough about the Folk Festival. I need to do a deep dive, maybe inspired by your podcast that we'll talk about in a minute. Like, how do we understand the history of it all? And it's funny because there's only one book that I found. There's probably more. J-Sweet, hook me up, send them my way. But I only found one book that wasn't about Bob Dylan disrupting the folk festival with his electric guitar. And every year I'm waiting for it to come back. And, you know, I got to see Bob Dylan at the Orpheum this year talk about a space that just music fills the room. And to have him sitting at the piano and playing his guitar was amazing. And I keep waiting for him to come back. But, I think about how you fit in and expand. It's like you can fit and you can expand. You can fit and you can expand into these spaces where people expect something. And, you know, I want to come back to this idea of this song that you created inspired by Joni Mitchell. Because two summers ago, I got to see her come out live with Brandi Carlile and friends. And I talk about at a cellular level how that experience was. Like, just saying that out loud, my body's tingling.
Yeah.
It was the most magical, iconic experience. They will forever shape joy, how I experience joy in my life.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about the song you wrote and why and how it's inspired by Joni Mitchell.
I don't honestly know how to write songs, you know, like, and I know that sounds so silly to say, and I catch all these it's funny. Like, I feel like I want to make a social media post. It's like, the best way to be an artist is to read every meme about how to be an artist and what it means to be an artist and try to incorporate every one of those into your life. And then you are an artist. You know, like, we're just bombarded by so much information. Like, art is this and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then there's so many things online and so many books about how to write a song. And my favorite thing about writing actually is Stephen King's book on writing. The first chapter, where, you know, summarized quickly and vaguely, is you fill your toolbox with every tool you can get your hand on and then forget about your toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And
besides The Alchemist, that's the second book that I give to all the people I work with, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Coincidence.
This is perfect.
Yeah.
This
great.
Is just this
so
is
great.
Some synergy.
Uh-huh.
And I forget what happened first. Like, you know, I had this part of the song. The song's called Cover of Clouds because I forget the order of things, but the album Clouds was bestowed upon me as a child from an adult in my life, who that was, you know, his music. And this adult also, you know, facilitated getting my first guitar, he had a guitar himself. And one of the first things he showed me before I could play a C chord was how to play Chelsea Morning, which is on Clouds. It was in an open tuning, completely complicated, just like, you know,
no big
just
deal.
Really trying to step ahead and couldn't quite do it. But, you know, so those indelible moments in the myth of your own life, and then the music that sticks with you and is embedded. But an artist such as Joni, that anytime you wanted to come back to in life, when you might leave an art form or a sound or an artist because you're distracted by your own, what is in your friend's group and things that are pulling you, like, if I'm going to listen to something else. Mm. But you could always come back to certain artists, and I think the ones that never stop creating, like if an Elvis Costello, a Paul McCartney, a Joni Mitchell, there's got to be some empirical scientific data about what that creates once in a lifetime creator, like a Picasso and stuff like that. And like, there are some people whose artistic creation is a pocket in their life. You know, there's some albums by acts that are one album and it's really great.
Yeah.
But the gateway that stays open when you can always come back and there's something new or a new story or deeper tracks you didn't know. And Joni was kind of always that for me. And recently around that time, this is like 2000 and or 21, I had always had Clouds in my room. Like, even as a kid, I would have it on the wall or in my studio at home. Now it's on my wall, the artwork. Mm. But I never knew that she painted it. And when I figured it out, I was like, damn it. Like, oh, one more awesome thing that she has to be able to do. I was like kind of angry with her and disgusted. And then I felt like, I can't paint. I can't paint my own covers. I'm such a loser, you know. Like, and I feel like Joni Mitchell is going to make me feel worse and worse. Like, and how, like, there's an aspect to being an artist while being comfortable and prostrate in the shadow of other artists' grandeur forever, and you'll never be able to do it. Be larger than their light. And that could, I think that can be true for any path in life and any kind of employment. Like, are you going to be bigger therapist than Sigmund Freud? Or are we going to be, you know, and does that make you less valuable? No.
Yeah.
You know, and not at all. And is a shadow if you're not in it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. We walk in the footsteps of giants.
Right. And if you aren't walking in them, is their path of any value?
Mm. And to your point, should everyone be the same? Should everything be
exactly
working out all the time? Yeah.
And so somewhere in that, I just had this like tone poem of glory to her and the trajectory of my life with her, you know, and thinking about my own role within echoes like artists like her.
Mm.
And also like what she had to do in that era to be not just good and write some like memorable songs, but like in like this completely unique way that has not been repeated. Like, people have repeated the Ramones, you know, and you just can't copy and paste Joni Mitchell. And you can Bob Dylan in a certain sense, you know, like he created a language for people to pull from because he knew what he was doing, pulling language. But like, she's pulling from way too many things to really understand. So I had this whole song and what happened was I had it in my brain and it was 2021 and we could finally be back in the studio with masks on. So I grabbed my long time, like, you know, BFF production partner, drummer. And I was like, all right, dude, we just need a therapy session, recording session. Let's just go do a song to see if we, after the trauma of lockdown, even know how to do this, if it's in us still, if it's important, if it matters, if we feel good doing it, let's go work with someone we never worked with instead of doing it ourselves. We worked with a guy named John Evans on Cape Cod, who's Tori Amos's bass player and music director for about 25 years, and a guy I've known for a while, and just always wanted to work together.
Cool.
Let's go out to John's place. The three of us just put our masks on and do this song. I go, just hear me out. It's got like a minute and a half overture, then the song part, and about another 2 minutes of an outro. It's just going to be a whole thing. And I'm not even worried about what we do with it. And we did it and finished it. And I was like, cool. I maybe send it off to a mixer and listen to it once. And then got on to like the next thing that he and my Dave Brophy and I were working on. And then one day, I was just like, hey, what happened to that therapy session? In a sense, you know? Which when it's not the therapy session anymore, almost like when you go do the work on yourself.
Yeah.
And you go back, oh yeah, who am I a year after I did that work on myself? Yeah. And I was driving over to Dave's. And I popped it on my car, like pulled up, where's that file, that mix from Cover of Clouds? It's called Cover of Clouds. And the refrain is like, you know, I'm under the cover of clouds because literally it's always been on my wall. I'm always in the shadow of it. I'll always be in the shadow of it, you know, as a creator.
Such a beautiful symbol.
And also confusing because people, you know, I never thought, well, I'll get to that part, but I'm driving to Dave's, I put it on and I get there. I was like, dude, you gotta come out to my car right now. Like, we made this. Like, oh my God, what do we do? But if I put a 7-minute song into the abyss of our digital lives and I send it to my very best friend or my mother, and I said, Mom, I have a new song I really need you to listen to. My mom's gonna get a text before my vocal comes in, you know?
Yeah.
Spiritually, I couldn't imagine throwing this song into the abyss. And so I continued to sit on it. And one day I was just saying to somebody, I said, I just wish I could like just play it for people one at a time and like just sit down and, dude, that sounds so silly. And I was like, wait. Oh, that's right. I can do whatever I want.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, wouldn't it be cool if I just had it on my merch table? And what would I do? Well, I guess I could put on a CD player. And they're like, well, get an iPod. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Like, And I looked up iPods and they're expensive to buy now, like on eBay. And a CD player was $40 and a nice pair of like studio headphones. And then, well, I'm like, well, then it's like a sociological experiment. And you can only hear it once. And we'll have a notebook and the lyrics will be in the notebook and people can write in the notebook after. And all of a sudden I've been running this like sociological experiment for the past 8 months. And the song is expensive to produce, to then not release. I was spending money on it therapeutically without thinking of what I was doing. And I had a like big debt to this song too. And I've made the money back on that from this. But really what's happening is people are choosing in the tent. You know, I reverse engineered it where I didn't think, all right, what am I going to do with this song? It's like I had the song and thought, I want to do this. I was like, all right, well, $10 sounds about right because it's a shocking number. To listen to something once. I always say, like, if you have a dollar, I mean, some people are like, here's 20.
Yeah.
How come not $9.99?
Right, exactly. Like, and I didn't want to mix up that thinking, right?
Yeah.
Or that world.
I got you.
I wanted to say, what? I have a $10 song.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way to start the conversation. Because I couldn't say it's called Cover of Clouds. And it's about, then it's like, you did a Cover of Clouds? No. I have to explain so many things. And so it's not like I really thought this out because it is a little bit cumbersome on the explanation. And I usually don't on stage or too much describe the Joni Mitchell part yet, you know, but I let that just kind of seep in because I also don't like describing songs too much as I like this prescription aspect of like, I hope it is what it is for you. And sometimes for me, trying to mess with what a song is about and the genre and then someone's reaction is my reverse entertainment. Like I have this one song in my catalog that's very poppy and weird and a little left and it's about a really dark thing. Yeah. And some people are like, that was our wedding song. I was like, oh, that is so horrible. Delicious, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine.
And that's a little bit fun. I like to be entertained too. And I'm not going to say them because I don't want to ruin people's weddings. But
I was going to ask you the name, but now I don't want to know.
Yeah, no, and it's not. it's in. So, anyways, a couple things that shocked me were how when we're throwing things into that abyss and we're asking everyone to click on our artwork and we're trying to find time in other people's hearts and minds in this tyranny of content that we're in society, not just music, all the shows, all the movies, all the news articles, all the links.
Consumerism.
It is
you forget
just
most of it.
A tyranny. and not a human experience.
Right.
In my thinking is it would be not authentic of me and not responsible to what I feel like I know to demand to exist in that space and to say, I'm going to climb to the top of that inverse mountain to demand your time because my job is connection.
Yes. Yeah.
If my job is connection and I know that's an inauthentic request, I can't exist only there.
Yeah.
So this project with a $10 song is an investment in what I've been saying here is my job. And I did not know that the dopamine response of being able to say like, my album's out today, getting a bunch of texts from people and responses feels good for that day. And what happens for every artist out there, I guarantee you top to bottom, is they get that dopamine response, they get that ego boost, and it just declines. Occasionally, like in someone like Joe P, like, well, he has his first thing, so it's always on the up and up.
Yeah.
His next one, he's going to be at one of those things where, damn, the next one didn't do the up and up because you can't always go up and up.
Right.
Yeah.
So, what happened was I announced this project. Everyone on my team was like, what the hell, man? Come on. You know, like my manager's like, this is your best song. I was like, you're just saying that because and a lot of fans are like, this is my favorite song you ever did. I was like, then you get to have a conversation of, would you feel that way? We'll never know. We have no control group here.
It's awesome.
Oh, right. Exactly.
But is the setting part of our experience? So I get to have those kind, I'm getting to explore that data. I'm getting to have those conversations and that emotional exchange with people. I am having people who've never heard me before when I was on tour with the Wallflowers this summer get in line to do it, sit at the merch table and start bawling. And we get to have the conversation of why.
Yeah, you know, chills right now thinking how
important
that is.
Is it because of the song? And I'm the first to be like, let's explore the fact that it might not be. It might be that I've said that you're important by saying like you're the only one right now who can hear it. And I think you deserve that. And I think we all kind of deserve that. And look, like Pearl Jam just announced a new album. There's a big like heritage, what would we call like a vintage band, but like a been around forever, right?
And you're buddies with them, right? This is a resume plug for you.
No, but I played with them before. I played with Eddie Vedder before and Will again and have been a lifelong, like I was a kid. And it's like built into my existence, right? Yeah. And I'm a fan and he's one of the nicer, more genuine, kinder, creative people I've ever met.
Yeah.
If they announced their new album was only available on vinyl, I would have bought 10 copies yesterday.
Yeah.
Or something, you know. But it's going to be thrown into that abyss.
Yeah.
And I'm a fan, you know, If someone, I don't, like Beyonce just announced a new album. I haven't checked it out, the songs yet, but I love her and I always appreciate like the directions she takes. Mm. If she said, okay, you know, it's harder for her to do like, I'm going to put it on vinyl, someone put it on YouTube, but she also has the power to take anything down anywhere and everywhere, you know? Yeah. And these days, people aren't passing around digital files anymore like they were in 2005. Mm. So if Beyonce announced like it's vinyl and CD only right now, I would have gone and bought it immediately.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause she would have said like, I really want your time to feel like it matters listening to this and not be on this device where all of things are asking for your attention. That's how much I value this music. And I'm not saying she is not doing that intentionally. I'm just saying we're all getting robbed of connection and the teams around us and the construct around. Everyone is doing everything it can to monetize our passions, our fears, and our insecurities. And we're giving away a lot of free labor. Mm-hmm. Our thumbs, all times, are free labor to all these companies. And they are monetizing it, and we're not getting anything for our time. And that will change.
Yeah.
Like 7-year-olds were smoking cigarettes in 1930. Okay. Things change. All That's the right. tragedies That's right. that we experience every day, whether it be gun violence, mm-hmm. whether it be conflicts in the industry that is based off of conflict and war, mm-hmm. it's hard to imagine. Just like it's hard to imagine Tower Records going away, it's mm-hmm. hard to imagine Spotify going away one day. All these things bend towards going away. Mm-hmm. How they go away is what we can't control. How soon they go away, it's what we can't control. But the idea of like, everyone throwing their music into the abyss will seem so horrible. Just like the idea of charging $25 for an NSYNC CD was absurd. Yeah. While also like…
I can't believe you remember that factoid.
Yeah. I was just like, well, I'm not paying for that. So, and the idea of a piece of metal being fired out of another piece of metal into someone's flesh will seem so archaic, just like an Iron Maiden or a guillotine is so archaic to us. It does come to pass. We just have to like start thinking outside the constructs.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the one thing that we can predict and we can expect is that things are going to constantly change and evolve.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And can I say something real quick?
Yeah, please.
This is what I kept thinking about and it kept like resonating in my head. Kept thinking like all my favorite artists or bands over the years are the ones that I originally saw live.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think you're speaking to how important that connection is, like the genuine connection with the people that you like. And they're the ones who I actually like long term, mm-hmm. that they stay with me. Last week we had Haley Reardon on, we interviewed her. She opened for you. What a sweetheart and just an amazing artist. And not only did she talk about the organic process of songwriting and wanting to hold on to that and get back to that all the time, but also just, you know, the reason I connect so much with her music is partly because I saw her perform,
Right.
And there's something that resonates with her energy and the way she put music together that her, like other people that we've seen, it's not because like, you know, you hear something and then you don't hear it again or other people are listening to it. Alexis always says, people think what you hear more and more and more is important just because you're hearing a lot of it, right? You know, like a lot of popular songs are popular because someone just keeps playing them over and over and over.
It controls the means of delivery to your ears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you're like, oh, that reminds me of like when I was in 8th grade because I heard the song all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe it's a good song too and a quality song, but there's something about the connection and I guess I'm kind of bringing it back to that is it's a deep thing. And like you said earlier, is like, culturally, across the world, music has been embedded in culture and connection and community in all facets of life. Yeah. And there's something very deep about that.
Well, yeah, and I'm always trying to protect my art too from all these things that don't matter, you know. But here's the real fact of what you described about where you were as a kid and you heard music, or who controls the delivery of information controls what information we know. Mm-hmm. And that goes for music. Now, as we've said music has existed for tens of thousands of years, and it's been part of humanity on the cellular level and part of our evolution, and is the original art form, you know, in the sounds that we make. You know, someone was hunted a woolly mammoth, someone carved it up, and then some dude is like, not really a good hunter, not really good at carving it up or cooking it up, grabbed the ribs and like started beating on a rock. And the other guy's like, oh, that's a pretty good beat.
Fred Flintstone.
Yeah. And the guy was like, well, thanks. Just like something I came up with. And he's like, are you going to do anything with that? And like, I don't know. It's just like a little idea I got. And then the other Neanderthals are just like, well, maybe later on when we're like eating the woolly mammoth, you could like play it for everyone and we could all join in. And that's like a funny way of like saying the truth.
Yeah.
And that's, it's been with us forever. Okay. Recorded, deliverable music is 100 years old. Music is 100,000 years old.
Well, yeah, good point. Good comparison.
We lived in a part of a renaissance. That renaissance is over. Like all other renaissance. Renaissancees, as Renaissance says.
Renaissance.
Renaissancees. Someone's in the car right now. Like, it's pronounced Renaissance as adults. Whatever, you know. Anyways. What we are unable to do right now within the industry and within culture, while everyone's like, what's happening to music and Spotify's not paying enough and blah, blah, blah. We have to first acknowledge the Renaissance and then acknowledge that it's over. Be grateful for it, wave goodbye, and think about how you celebrate a renaissance just like you do for every other art form and medium. Music is an overall piece of art, the original piece of art. But watercolor had a renaissance. Oil base, marble statue. People are still painting in watercolor. People are still doing amazing things with watercolor, having careers with watercolor. They're just not in the renaissance of it. You know? We are still acting like the Renaissance is happening. And once part of the $10 song or part of releasing Easy to Be Around with the credits or what I know, I have a record in the can right now that'll be out this year. I have another behavior that will be invested like ethically like I have been.
Can't wait.
I am obeying that knowledge that I feel like I the way I see it, right? And I think it's an important thing to talk about if we're going to talk about what is the correct value of music, you know? And when AI is coming on, it's going to change everything and so on and so forth. Because to your point about live music, it's going to be hard. You can't disrupt that. Because that is the part that isn't the renaissance. That is a right to being human, like eating, like hunting and gathering.
You can't digitize live music unless you're YouTube. Right. You have the whole thing going on.
Right. And
I'm
like,
just kidding.
But you know, getting up there with the turntable is a part of that connective part. Yeah. But being up there and doing it with people in the room is where it lands, you know? And that's why some people are like, I just don't understand. Like the guy's just up there on a stage. We're like, oh, have you gone to a DJ night and had a great time and had a great time and felt connected to everyone moving and grooving around you and the choices that DJ was making, if they're really good.
And there's so many different ways to enjoy live music.
That's it. That's all I'm talking about.
Everyone's so different.
That's right.
Yeah. That's great, yeah.
And you can do it with an acoustic guitar. You can do it just by humming and chanting or getting everyone else singing along. And that belongs to all of our humanity and it's throughout all culture because it is that ancient.
So you're both in education and somebody I work with is a musician. In my practice, and he made this comment about how certain cultures, generally speaking, most people are musical in nature. Like they can have rhythm, they can dance. And I don't really know the science or like the research or the anthropological explanation for this, but he was suggesting it's because they're exposed to music, like real music, not digital music, but like music growing up, that it's their brain is kind of developing to appreciate and understand music in its, in its real time form.
Yeah. No, it is the one thing that should be primary with language from onset, from preschool on. And by not having it, you can, weaken a population. And I think, America, by not having those things, by not having language, not just English, but exposure to language,
yeah,
and having music, because music empirically accesses all corners of the brain and unites them. And when you're performing music or dancing to music, you are engaging all corners of the brain. I can't recite all the corners' names,
but
this is actual.
No, it's real.
Scientific data.
Yes. The corpus callosum.
Yeah,
the left and the right.
Yep. Exactly.
And there's research on that.
And the connectome, it's beautiful.
And by denying that, you atrophy the system and the development. Yep. And you keep, you kind of find us in a situation where we're in culturally, and you're unable to shift and all that. And
let me make a quick point about that. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you, is that perhaps that's also suggesting that it helps us to integrate our thinking left and right side of the brain,
yeah,
the logical, the intuitive side of the brain, left and right. And actually music has been shown to, like you said, merge the two. They communicate with each other.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's, you know, important for, as you're saying, flexible thinking, which is what you're applying, being able to think in a non-all or nothing black and white way.
That's 100% what
Thank
I'm
Thank you for the saying, plug, Chair. Yeah. Yeah, it's right on.
That's exactly it. And you know, music helps me sniff out people who are stuck with that, you know, and part of that, like not adhering to a genre is a commitment on my part, because sometimes I get insecure about that. And I'm always told like, man, you got to choose. And like the algorithm's dumping you out because a song like Higher Education's banjo. If they're all banjo, you'd be like in the algorithm for banjo music.
Mm.
Like, well, I just wanted to write one banjo song. That's the one, you know, I made that. You've heard me say those stories, but like,
yeah.
Wow.
And again, when you feel like passionately about the fact that, well, by the person who likes my banjo song, and then they go listen to maybe a heavier song or a weirder song or whatever it is, or a poppier song. Maybe I'm like just connecting a synapse there, you know? And that's within my power to try to do with my time on this earth as like the job, going back to the job, right? And because it also just pisses me off that we're in this...
Mm.
culture where we're getting robbed of the most powerful points of our humanity.
I love that you talked about like just feeling things on a cellular level and sensorially sometimes being in live music halls is overwhelming for people. But
but
I think that's the one thing that can't also be replicated. Not only is there this like energetic connection that's happening, but there's the music you listen to, and then there's the feeling you experience when you're immersed with music and other people sharing a similar experience together.
Yeah.
Jofi said it's when your mind shuts down.
Yeah.
Like people just like, you're not thinking anymore.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. The bill's not there. The laundry's not unfolded.
Well, it's a beautiful thing. And for those of you who are listening who aren't familiar with Will's work and storytelling and beautiful way in which you articulate so much of yourself and your experience, you'll probably be noticing that he has so many really great historical references.
Mm.
And I mentioned earlier, and Jerry just mentioned recently, that, you know, you have a background in education too, right? And we talked about this previously, that being able to educate and to share and to guide, I think is such an important piece of, again, being human.
Mm-hmm.
It's a privilege I think we have, especially when we are in tune enough with ourselves to be able to be vulnerable and open to doing that. But you've done this new thing too, not just the $10 song, but recently you started this podcast, Sound of Your Town, where not only are you just like dipping in, sharing your experiences of performing in these different cities and towns, but you give like the most beautiful historical, cultural experience. You bring people into what it feels like to be in these cities and towns. And I imagine part of it is, you know, your experience as a musician touring and getting to meet new people and experience these places. But you are so careful with how you prepare and share these stories. And if you haven't listened yet, you absolutely have to listen to Will's podcast, because it's a whole different experience. And it literally is like you're stepping into these cities for the first time, even if you've maybe lived there your whole lives. Can you share a little bit about where that came from and what that's like for you?
Yeah, like I like I said before, we're in the tyranny of content. So when this company approached me to do a podcast, I was like, do we need another podcast?
Yeah, that's
like,
what we were joking about.
Like, yeah, we all feel like that, right? When we make, and every day I'm like, does the world need another song? You know, all these things. Like, but they were said, you know, well, what if there's essentially a record label that does music podcasts, and they said, you know, what it's about, we have an idea called Sound of Our Town. And it's just you talking about each episode's a different city in the live music culture there. And that was it. Mm. That was the prompt, you know? And so I like signed this podcast record deal essentially in 2019. However, it was about travel and live music. So we were ready to go in 2020, January. And then that was put on ice for a long time. And you know, when I was putting the show together, I just thought, all right, couple rules. I cannot worry about getting it right, because you cannot encapsulate a song, a city's music culture in a podcast. Mm. And you can't, you know, talk about music appropriately. This almost has to be like a shot across the bow, or a just this, like, what is that? Like, a quick calling you to just a wake up to what's there. And then the other one was like, it can't be longer than a set of music, because I can't make this show about live music and have it be longer than going to see live music. You know,
I didn't realize that.
Unethical.
That's great.
And, but I was like, well, this show could be really overall about its importance, everything we've been talking about, its importance in our lives, more than it is about where to go. And the where to go part is like this utility thing that seems really appropriate, you know, but I wanted to just start the intrigue. I wanted the people in these towns who are inevitably going to be like, but you forgot about this, and we don't really do that. Yeah, as I would do if someone else was doing it about Boston, I'd be like, well, they didn't even mention me. Like, you know, all these things, right?
Yeah.
Of course, I'm like, that is actually a goal.
Yeah.
Because if everyone's posting about it and saying like, they got this wrong, they're advocating for their community.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
And so it was really just post-pandemic, something designed secretly as a utility, but to be there to reestablish this ancient practice that we've kind of been talking about, right?
Yeah.
And do it in a modern delivery system with a seemingly something that has a utility, and just kind of get it going. The first season. Well, I remember you writing me, be like, how are you doing this? And I'd be like, I am dying. And like, the reason why, like, my album, I don't have an album out, is because of like this podcast. I just had no idea. Because we had to write, you know, each episode was like making an album, because it was a 10-page script.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then soundscaped and edited and everything. In season two, I was like, all right, I actually need like real writers with me on each one. And like, season two started with writers meetings and like, okay, here's what I want, and go write it. And then I would edit and then write a couple sections.
Great.
You know, because I was just like, I
don't know how you were doing it.
I couldn't do music anymore if I was making that, you know?
And, yeah.
And I was losing gigs and like the way I make money. So, but we had a good thing. It's good. And we're waiting to see what happens to it going forward. But the good thing about it is it's evergreen. And I think what we might do, because things change so much in season one, there's every episode at least has one club that's closed, is just update the cities we have.
That's wild.
You know, keep it rolling that way.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, because we did do like 22, 24 cities already.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot. You've done a lot. And,
for me to really do it, which is, you know, it just have to be like high production level stuff. It's like, I have to be embedded in the city for a week and talk to everybody. And that's just not possible unless
I can imagine
huge
you
budget.
Wanted to like do all the
Yeah. And that was just a really hard, the hard part. And I had to learn on the fly, because I said yes to doing it. But
yeah. I get it.
It has been nice, and that's like nice, like, well, it's still just like out there and people are still listening to it.
Yeah.
You know? And I was, again, like tending to the soil in which my roots are.
Yeah.
By making it, not just otherwise. I wouldn't have done it if that wasn't true. And I do a lot of that elsewhere in my life with my manager and stuff like that. The things we do in Boston, at least, we work with a lot of companies and get money into artists' hands and stuff like that. So
tell us a little bit about that.
Well, years ago, you know, I would get a call from some brand and be like, hey, can we use your song? Or can you be in this photo shoot or this video? Or can we sponsor a tour? And then I was just starting to learn, working with these companies, what that meant. And then I would start running my mouth off and say, well, what if we did this? What if we did that? And a couple of them just said, well, let's come in and talk about it. And one of them was Bose.
Yeah.
Who at first, like, they used a song of mine. And then they asked me for a photo shoot. And then I did some shows for them in Mexico on, like, a new product. They're like, can we just do, like, 3 concerts in Mexico City where you play on this new sound system that we designed in a concert hall. And they're like, hey, and they were like, hey, check out this new thing we're thinking of developing. What do you think about it as like a professional? And I'll be like, oh, maybe that means I get to get one, you know, or maybe I can get some headphones. And that's how I like thought at that time.
Excited,
right.
Yeah.
And then a friend was like, you're consulting. And I was like, wait, what? What's that? And it's like, people charge them. It's like, right, so like ask for $100? Like, what do you mean? And a set of headphones? So I've been kind of learning on the fly, but Bose has been a great partner. And so I've worked on a lot of products that go into artists' hands now for many years. And I am artist in residence at Omni Seaport in Boston. And we have people playing in the hotel all the time. We're about to start a jazz weekend, and I'm curating a jazz weekend all the jazz players I know in town. And you know, facilitating places to perform where there's a global audience, you know, in the restaurant, this restaurant Kestra at Omni Seaport Boston. And there's going to be Thursday, Friday, Saturday jazz there.
That's sweet.
In the lobby, there's, you know, it's easy for me to get a gig in town, or if like Omni called and said, hey, will you play in the lobby? It's like, all right, well, I don't play lobbies, but sure. Do you really want somebody singing or people checking in? But you know what doesn't happen to the cellist who plays on my album? She doesn't get a lot of gigs just playing cello somewhere.
Mm.
And I thought, well, man, I check into a lot of hotels around the world. If I walk into one and there's, I imagine my friend who plays cello playing there, I'd be like, this hotel is special. Or my friend Lightfoot, who like makes beats and cuts beats and is a beautiful beat maker. If I walked in and heard him doing it live in the lobby, I'd be like, this place is special. So I'm able to create a work environment for the people that I need to do well in Boston to make records with me still.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm able to facilitate an experience. So that's another thing that I do, you know, is just a lot of like creative problem solving for brands. My manager helps me out a lot with it because I'm bad at the
logistics are hard.
Yes. the logistics of it.
I love that. I mean, you really are the ultimate connector. And I'd be remiss without kind of closing things out asking, Sound of Your Town, you started with Asbury Park.
Yeah.
Tell us about your connection there, because that actually rooted our connection a little further. We mentioned Joe P several times, who's a cousin of my brother and myself, obviously, who started off, you know, Asbury Park down at the Yacht Club playing in residence.
Yeah, so
and
cool.
Developed this great relationship with Danny Bones, who I know is a friend of yours too.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can share a little bit about that before we close things out.
Well, I mean, Asbury Park, I mean, it's like that. It's really interesting. Like, there's Graceland for Elvis. There's Dollyville, I'm for Dolly Parton or whatever. There's, you know, Seattle is associated with the grunge movement, and so on and so forth. But there's a living icon in Bruce Springsteen, and he owns. He doesn't literally own it, but like there is an energy from what he created for Asbury Park. Or, you know, and it wasn't just him creating it, but and the way it's kind of ridden this wave throughout time. And it has an energy to it. And it's very specific. But in 2021, was I doing the 100 shows?
Yeah.
So in 2021, I was doing the 100 shows. And one of them was in Asbury Park at Danny Clinch's photo gallery. And I had met him once before when I was playing with Eddie Vedder. briefly, you know, but he's like photographing Pearl Jam. So I didn't meet him that quickly. And then I was playing with, on Pearl Jam's festival in California. And Danny was there photographing everybody. He's like, hey, man, you're coming to my studio soon. And I was like, yeah. And so that was 2021. And I get to that show a couple months later. And he made sure he was there. He's a very busy man. He photographs every music icon in the world and flies all over and does every album cover. And I'm sitting there in the studio playing and rolling around town, just like, this place is, I haven't been here in a while and it's got a vibe. Cause the last time I was there, I was playing The Saint and it was, we were like, it was one of those gigs. We were on the road and on a tour and there was like 10 people in the room. One of my favorite shows ever. Oh, and those usually end up being my favorite shows cause I love, I don't like to have them too often. But when I do, it's like, those 10 people are like, oh, what's, why isn't there, they feel bad there's not more people there. Or maybe one of them's like, why aren't there more people here? And then you give them like the most incredible show. And again, you upset the expectations. So I hadn't been there in a while since, and the town had kind of turned around. And I'm sitting in Clinch's studio with all my heroes on the wall. Mm-hmm. And they're like behind you, in front of you, surrounded. And there's an audience there. And I was like, this is like kind of mentally intimidating for me. And I started, I need to like work this out emotionally right now. And I played like 8 of my own songs. I was like, let me just quickly play a Bruce Springsteen song. Oh, there's a picture of Tom Waits. Let me just play a Tom Waits song. There's the Beastie Boys. I did like a folk version of Sabotage.
Then I did
a folk version of 99 Problems. Like all these songs that I've had in my being. Like I think as a young 20-something, I played a lot of like bars and covers to like make ends meet and stuff like that. And every odd job I was working. And Clinch was just like, dude, people have been playing here forever. No one's done that.
No way. And then
we've been best friends since. And,
that's awesome.
He's actually on my new record. And
that's great.
We got along fast, which is weird because the guy who did the artwork for my album, Golden Walker, he's doing the artwork. He's like listening to the album while he's doing the artwork and design. He said, man, my friend Danny Clinch I just get the feeling he would love you. And I'm like, oh, you know, and now the three of us talk. We're just like, yeah,
that's awesome.
You knew we'd be friends, man. We just become best friends. We did.
That's great.
So Danny's always been really, I know it's been since 2021, so 3 years, but like I've been playing there a ton in that time. And so it was with like Bruce Springsteen in my life and like the artists that, the family members that were like my aunt, that's her mecca. And it's just an easy episode to kind of do emotionally, you know. And I had a vision for it, and in the way the concert hall there has kind of fallen into the sea. I thought that was an important perspective. But
yeah, it was very cool. And right after that first episode came out, we were all at Sea Here Now, right in Asbury Park on the beach. This huge festival Danny Clinch puts together with his team. And you and Joe P were on the bill for one of the late night shows.
That's right.
Just very cool things. And I'm just grateful that you exist in this world in this way, Will, to be quite honest.
I'm glad I exist too, but
in the way you do. I mean, I think it's so that's unique. Sweet. Again, I think it really is very courageous. I mean, Jerry and I work with people every day who feel and experience a lot of the same things that you shared here today and sometimes don't know how to integrate that into their worlds and their lives. And I hope that listeners who tune into this episode feel inspired and feel courageous and feel connected to something that maybe they don't see in front of them all the time, but maybe they can hear in your stories and the way you share so much of yourself.
I love it. And to not be afraid of the journey, because look at this guy. What a great, you know, man right here that we're getting to sit next to. And there's a journey that went into it. And I think the people we work with are at the beginning or the middle stages of that journey. So this is a great testament to that.
One final thought is like, we are all in a world, no matter where we are in our life, like we're interconnected in a digital way that is constantly telling us we're not enough. And in the industry of music, something that happens to me often night to night is like someone will come up, it could be a lifelong fan, and they'll say, I don't know why you're not bigger. And I go, I want you to know that you are enough for me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Because if you feel that way, like I should be bigger, that means that's how much space I hold in your heart.
Mm.
What could be better than that?
Oh my gosh.
And when someone new comes up and says, oh, I'm so glad I discovered you and I get to say I saw you when.
Mm.
I go, I want you to know like this moment right now doesn't get better than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And you having this feeling is everything I dream of when I try to get to that stage or get to the studio or get to my guitar. So we have this thing in our hands that has the whole world that's telling us some number or our connectivity or who we know or how many people we know or how many connections we have is not enough at all times. Mm-hmm. And that's its design at this current moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we have lost or not allowed to hold power to the point of just this one right here, like the three of us.
Mm.
Who cares if anybody listens to this? Yeah. Think about the way that we feel.
100%.
Right exactly. Now.
That's exactly it.
This is why we do this.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's beautiful.
Beautiful thing.
So
I don't think. Maybe we'll cut this out because that was probably the best way of summing everything up. But this is like a lighter note to end on. So I often look at who goes into the production of a song. Apple Music is one of the platforms that actually shows like everybody. Spotify not as much, I think. So I look on Apple Music and I'm looking at one of my favorite songs. And by the way, I have an all-time favorite playlist of all my all-time favorite songs.
This is another something beautiful that came from something difficult. You started this during COVID, right?
100%, yeah. And so one of my favorite songs of yours is Counting on Karma.
Oh, wow.
I love that song. And I'm just going through the credits. I'm like, all right, so looking at the credits, obviously you're on the top as the performer. There's some people who went into other aspects, background harmony and stuff like that. And then I see, oh, someone was on the clapping. And I said to myself, who is on the clapping? Oh, it turns out to be none other than the legendary Boston Red Sox, Kevin Youkilis. Like Yuke, right? Like the legend of Boston Red Sox and Red Sox Nation. And I'm thinking to myself,
clap tracks.
When you need claps, you have to get the best.
Unbelievable. First of all, did he go solo with his clapping?
There's a couple other clappers in there with him, but he was clearly the leader and the one that whose mic we turned up the most because they were just really warm, great hands. You know, when you can take a ball in the hand like that, you know, sometimes raw, and get it over to first base or to second, they're going to be good claps.
How did that happen?
Like again, you know, you go to the registry of clappers and he's up there. He's one of my dearest friends.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised by that. He's beloved life, by everybody.
Yeah.
Takes one to know one, huh?
Yeah.
That's
thank
amazing.
You so much, Will, for joining us today. We thank really you. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
You're the best, man. Thanks.
I know we are late. Would you mind playing a song?
Good foot forward in the deep, and all I heard was a scream from the blue mystery. Someday you're gonna have to face your dreams. Torn from fields and dropped into the sea, chased the sun down with friends I'd never meet. And pressure is only an embrace I can never leave. Someday you're gonna have to face your dreams. Someday you're gonna have to face your dreams. want no one arresting me. At the bottom with treasure no man keeps. Well, if the air surrenders, it is there I will sleep. Someday you're gonna have to face your dreams. Someday you're gonna have to face your dreams. Someday you're gonna have to face your dreams.
Thanks for tuning in to the Reed Connected podcast. Please remember that this is a podcast intended to educate and share ideas, but it is not a substitute for professional care that may be beneficial to you at different points of your life. If you are in need of support, please contact your primary care physician, local hospital, educational institution, or support staff at your place of employment to seek out referrals for what may be most helpful for you. Ideas shared here have been shaped by many years of training, incredible mentors, research, theory, evidence-based practices, and our work with individuals over the years, but it's not intended to represent opinions of those we work with or who we are affiliated with. The Reconnected podcast is hosted by siblings Alexis Reed and Dr. Gerald Reed. Original music is written and recorded by Gerald Reed. Editing and recording was done by Cybersound Studios. If you want to follow along on this journey with us, the Reconnected podcast will be releasing new episodes every 2 weeks each season. So please subscribe for updates and notifications. Feel free to also follow us on Instagram at Reed Connected Podcast. That's Reed Connect Ed Podcast, and Twitter at Reed Connect Ed. We are grateful for you joining us and look forward to future episodes. In the meanwhile, be curious, be open, and be well.